The financial stability of the healthcare system has been tenuous at best for many years. Health systems traditionally operate at razor-thin margins, yet they have only become more complex, either by embracing growth strategies through mergers and acquisitions, or adapting to shifts in care delivery models from inpatient to outpatient. The challenge of a health system CFO is difficult. Now couple that with the rise of the consumer patient that is also carrying a heavier burden of share of wallet with their healthcare expenses, and it's clear that the system is facing a financial crisis. But now, with the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, record high unemployment rates, and two-thirds of hospital executives predicting full-year revenues decreasing by 15%, will the healthcare system be able to afford to continue in the same way in a post-COVID-19 world? Welcome to The New Normal, conversations about the future of healthcare from Touchpoint Media. Through interviews with leading industry experts, this program explores how the current public health crisis is forcing our industry to transform and change. In this episode, I speak with Michael Krivich, corporate healthcare business and marketing strategist. As a 30-year veteran in the healthcare industry, Michael has worked in senior leadership positions in hospitals, health systems, GPO, specialty pharmacy, and also internationally. An international recognized influencer, his blog Healthcare Marketing Matters is read in 52 countries. Michael works as an independent consultant for hospital businesses and marketing strategy. Listen in as we discuss how the fiscal side of healthcare delivery might change in a post-COVID-19 world. I was recently reading an article and it said that 33 million people have filed for unemployment benefits since the pandemic took hold. And they say the unemployment rate is nearly 15%. They even project that as many as 7 million people will be left uninsured as a result of this economic crisis precipitated by the coronavirus. From an individual perspective or a consumer or patient perspective, there's an impact to their pocketbook, and that will impact the way they seek out care.
Oh, absolutely. You can see it already in what's going on out there. I mean, even when people were employed, what you had was a situation where because of the pandemic and services shutting down both in the physician offices and within the hospitals and the health systems, people stopped because of fear, stopped even going for their normal medical needs. So you have that impact that was going on. Now, one thing I would like you to consider, and just as a thought, that of those 7 million uninsured, when you look at the breadth and the depth of the layoffs across the economy, a lot of those were service workers who may have not been insured in the first place. So I don't know if there's really truly a new 7 million uninsured in there. What I have seen, though, is that a lot of employers that have furloughed in some situations or have done laid off where they can, they have continued to pay for the individual and the family's health insurance, which was with effort, I guess, of social good. But 7 million people is still 7 million uninsured. That's a lot of financial burden that's being placed on hospitals and health systems. It's a continuation of the medicalization of social issues.
It's interesting because we've said this before, and I think it's relevant. This pandemic has done a lot of things to our society, but one thing it really has is kind of highlighted the challenges that we've had and how many of the service line workers, the people that work in bars, restaurants, even grocery stores, supply chain, that sort of thing, those are people that have not stable, secure health insurance, and they've been already parceling out the type of expenses they have towards healthcare. This will probably have a significant impact on what they're going to do. Add to that also the fear about going to a hospital. And we are starting to think about this at a much more broader level. Before, we were rallying around doing GoFundMes and different things to get people to be able to pay for healthcare. Do you think that that's going to carry through between, just individuals and society in the post-pandemic world?
You know what? I think it will. I think it will somewhat. Looking on, if you can call it a bright side, and that may be the wrong terms on my part, Chris, there's always been, I think, an underlying understanding that healthcare is a right. It's not a privilege. It's not something that only a few can afford or have access to, whether you can pay privately or you have employer-funded insurance. I think what this done, though, this has brought to the forefront the discussion, which has never taken place. Is healthcare a right or a benefit discussion? The question that's always been ignored by everyone, all the industry players, the government, the hospitals and health systems, the insurance companies, the associations, everything that's gone out there, how do we pay for it? And now we're looking at that situation where we're understanding, I think, that that discussion is now going to move to the forefront, that we have to do something. We have to understand. We can no longer say the platitudes that, you know, yeah, healthcare is a right. We now have to have that discussion of how do we pay for it. And I think that's going to have a far-reaching impact on the health system and how we deliver healthcare in the United States. That's not something that's going to happen overnight, but I think it's on the table.
And the implications of that are far-reaching into the healthcare industry. And one of the first ones that I think about when we talk about, you know, this kind of shift around healthcare being right are the payers themselves. And I remember at the onset of this pandemic, I remember hearing that from a Medicare-Medicaid perspective, one of the leaders in front of Congress made a commitment that said to everybody that any kind of expenses that are burdened upon the individual around coronavirus in terms of testing and treatment will be 100% free. In effect, they made a promise, we have universal health care coverage, albeit for this one particular condition. And subsequently, all the private insurers kind of fell in line. And then, and again, there are other things that have happened. I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I noticed that Eli Lilly made an announcement that said they're going to reduce the cost of insulin throughout this pandemic to a more affordable rate, you know, very affordable rate. Do you think that the payers and those that kind of regulate the costs and that could extend into the government, what is their role in making sure that healthcare insurance will be affordable in a realistic way, Michael?
For, I guess the first thing you have to ask is, what are their shareholders expecting?
Oh, boy.
It's the truth. I mean, that's something that we don't like to talk about in the industry. I'm not being negative here. I want to be really clear for you and the audience. I'm not being negative. But so much of the healthcare industry in the United States is for profit. They have shareholders. They have investors. They have to have some kind of return so they can continue to access capital. Now, understanding that, here's the quandary. They have stepped forward and they said, now, you know, this is extraordinary circumstances. We have a social responsibility. In your case, it was lowering the cost of insulin for you. Optum and Blue Cross Blue Shield and United Healthcare and some of the other ones that have gone out there, they have taken a social responsibility stand going, this is different. Now, and we're not gonna charge copays, we're not gonna charge deductibles, you know, your care is taken care of, don't worry about that. That doesn't mean there's extra money for the hospitals or doctors, they're gonna get their fee schedule. They didn't say they were going to pay the copays, okay? So understand that the hospital payment, the doctor payment is gonna be minus what the patient copay would be, they're just not requiring it to be accepted. Now, here's the quandary going forward. As we begin to move out of the pandemic and we get into a quote-unquote post-pandemic world until the fall and the flu season arrives and they're expecting the big resurgence again, what happens in between that? If Eli Lilly has said, I can reduce the cost of drugs during the pandemic, why can't they keep that going forward? So there is risk, I think, for them to understand, well, if you could do it now, why can't you keep it going forward? So there's going to be those questions that will be coming to the table, and how that plays out, I don't know.
The other thing that I always am struck by is we have a fundamental issue with testing and being aware of the actual impact that coronavirus has. And many people are presenting, some of the statisticians are saying, many people are presenting in hospitals with symptoms that have not been initially diagnosed as COVID-related, yet they are. And I think it becomes notoriously difficult for us to even know if we're being impacted by coronavirus for many of the population that's out there, let alone figure out how to get that all reimbursed on the back end. You know, that fear of like us as individuals and the uncertainty of that, at the end of the day, treating this virus, there's a financial impact that, you know, our organizations have. I mean, we have to pay for it somehow, and it's not coming from, you know, out of thin air. I know that Congress actually enacted a really big relief bill, and a lot of that was kind of earmarked for hospitals, right? The hospitals that are overwhelmed by COVID-19. Isn't that just like putting a finger into the hole in the dike, so to speak?
Oh, it is. And it's just, and those were one-time payments. I mean, and whether or not they actually even covered any of the cost of treat, the true cost of treatment for COVID-19 with all the extra precautions, ICU, with the isolation, with with the PPE and everything else that goes into that and the additional testing. I guess something is better than nothing. I mean, that's probably not the best professional way to put it, but in the hospitals, and they're all taking the steps. They've furloughed staff. They have laid off staff. They have pulled back on marketing. They've pulled back on the other things, but you still have all that overhead. You still have all the debt that's due, you know, on the equipment that they bought. You still have the buildings that are sitting out there that they built. That stuff doesn't go away. And I haven't heard any of the banks or the bond agencies telling hospitals, oh, don't worry, you don't have to do your bond interest payment this month. And then on top of it, you look at the profitability of outpatient services and the elective surgeries. With that being gone, it's a double whammy. You lose all that income that's coming in the first place, even for the hospital, and consider this, the hospital physician practices that shut down. I mean, a hospital health system still may be losing the $180,000 a year per practice, but there was still a revenue flow from the visit that was generated. There was still the ancillaries, you know, the outpatient testing, the surgeries, the other things that result of that, which made up for those losses. They lost that income as well, too. So it's just not the focus of the inpatient services or the outpatient services that were lost, but it was also the own physician practices that were lost, compounding the situation of what's going on. Large health systems were doing pretty well because it's the economies of scale. Well, pretty well is relative, but the economies of scale that they have because of size and, you know, what they can do. Your small individual hospitals' margins were razor thin to begin with, and now they're in the negative. You know they're in the negative. And, you know, and compound that is, and you cut marketing is a direct expense. Boy, you know, you stop running ads, you stop doing this, you stop doing that. That flows right to the bottom line. But now you stop talking to your community. Now you have to reenter. Now you have to let them know that your outpatient services are open. You're doing elective surgeries. You can see your docs. How are you going to reintegrate? And where are you going to get the money now to do that, given the losses that you're facing because of treatment and being overwhelmed by COVID-19 patients?
Oh, you described a really perfect storm. I mean, and if you think about it, right now, we're at a point when we're recording this where hospitals are now starting to reintroduce elective surgeries, and a lot of them are rushing to the table to figure out how we could start to fill this back in. So how do we make up for that loss that we've had over the last 8 weeks or so that we've been kind of shut down? And, you know, the perfect storm of we're talking to individuals that have been fiscally impacted by this. They may have been putting off their care already for other reasons, but now they're even more so being judicious with their expenses. Let alone the fact that we've been kind of telling them, don't come to our hospital, use telemedicine to talk to your doctors while we figure out how to handle this coronavirus thing. So there's this kind of inherent fear in them returning to the hospitals. And not lost on me too, by the way, is the fact that the cost for telemedicine is much more affordable than an in-office visit, right?
Very much so. And if there's another silver lining in all this that's happened is that the pushing of telemedicine to the forefront and actually forcing, you know, it's harder for an older individual, but actually forcing the hospitals and health systems into telemedicine, which they have not overtly, but they were slow to adapt to. Then they've had to do that in a hurry, and now they're finding it's a pretty significant revenue source that's happening for them because so much now is being reimbursed. Now, the question, Chris, the wild card is that these were special rules where Medicare, Medicaid, and then the insurers, mm-hmm. you know, and the mm-hmm. payers in many ways. Again, we have a special situation here. We're going to reimburse, and here's what we're going to reimburse at, which may or may not be generous depending upon what your perspective is. But at the end of the day, how do you take that away when now the public, hey, this is pretty cool. I mean, I had a telemedicine visit with my doc. I contacted them on the internet and I had a telemedicine visit. We put my visit off for 2 weeks, you know, in a 14-day self-quarantine because of the symptoms I was expressing, you know, and it was great. And I made mention to her, I said, you know that you can bill Blue Cross Blue Shield and get paid for this. Oh, yeah, I know. I said, good. we're in the same place. There's a new convenience and a new service now that's been added to this. How do the government and how do the payers not do this going forward? Everything that happens today, though, everyone has this caveat that says, oh, it's a special circumstances. We understand. Now it very quickly becomes ingrained as a standard of care. And how do you not do this going forward when I have no problem doing a Zoom call with my doctor? I have no problem doing a phone call with my doctor. Matter of fact, I like it because I don't have to travel. And actually, instead of being there an hour and a half, I'm out of there in 10 minutes. Okay.
Well, and you even mentioned you're going to the local pharmacy. Now you have a disintermediate healthcare delivery network as well, because more and more organizations are getting into, you know, the private organizations like CVS and Walmart and others are, they're all coming to the table and they're saying, we're there as well. And by the way, we're offering a more accessible, more affordable approach to managing your care, not only COVID related, but the day to day with the rise of the quick cares and the fast care.
You can see where this is the end of the day, is that with the organization that they set this up with, because in the protocols, you know, if you're tested positive, they'll be cutting you the report, they'll be calling you to discuss. And when they call me, it's going to be, I have a primary care physician already. Now, the benefit is that they will identify all the people who may not have a primary care relationship, which is now the opportunity to get them into the healthcare system where they need to be.
So, Michael, you've worked with a lot of CFOs in your lifetime of working with organizations. The modern CFO now that's sitting in a hospital or a health system, they have a challenge ahead. If you were to talk to them and kind of paint a picture of what is a way for them to kind of get through this, what are some of the things that you would say to them?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to look at it, you know, it's what's going on in operations. And what I mean by operations, it's okay. You know, you're facing this tremendous fiscal challenge with an unknown future, with an unknown response from whether it's the government or it's the payers or the individual. What is your core business? At the end of the day, they've all got the opportunity now, instead of running around and creating all the centers of excellence and going, I get to go here, or I need to do this bariatric center, or I need to do this, or I need to do that, which takes resources, time, and energy. What's your core business? Have you identified, CFO, what keeps the lights on? That if everything in the world went away, what do you have that keeps the lights on? Now, how are you going to strengthen that going forward? So this is going to require, I think, a real strategic narrowing and a strategic focusing, not only financially, but also operationally and clinically, about what is it that we do? You know, are we all things to all people and spending resources on that? Or at the end of the day, what is it that is our first priority? You know, from, you know, 1 to 10, these are the 10 clinical services, inpatient, outpatient, that drive the revenue, that keep the doors open, that keeps the light on, that allows us to hire and pay people. And then the secondary tier of where do we need to go that supplements that, but would stay with us during times of crisis, if that kind of makes sense. I mean, it's a strategic focusing of, yes, you're in the healthcare business, but that doesn't mean being in the healthcare business, being all things to all people and duplicating necessarily what someone's doing down the street. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing that's going to come with that is, what role at the end of the day, and you've seen this as much as I've had over our careers, Chris, about the real lack of understanding of what marketing and public relations and engagement means to the hospital and brand and awareness. That needs to come to the forefront and move back to the table, because the marketing now has got to be completely different. The patient experience is completely different. You know, and I've seen this. I've seen this in the market that I lived in, from a major health system. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and here comes an ad on a TV set that was pre-pandemic. That's like, hey, we got all these locations and docs. Come on, see us. Come on down. You know, I just saw one in the local paper yesterday. Hey, we got a new doc that's taking patients. Come on down. That doesn't work anymore. You can't do that. Who knows why they did it? I mean, maybe because somebody said, you got to do something. So they picked it up and they did it and they did whatever, but the old messages won't work. So there needs to be a reordering and a re-understanding. But I think the biggest thing is, and they got a handle on their costs. They've done everything they can. They furloughed staff that they didn't want to, but they understood the business necessity to do that. They've moved resources to the areas. I mean, I've even seen situations where health systems actually, where hospitals weren't impacted, moved resources from that hospital to where they were needed, which is the whole point of having a health system. I would say to a CFO, what's your core? What are the things that keep you open and keep the lights on even through this? And how are you going to strengthen that going forward so that the shock is, that can't be eliminated, but the shock is reduced?
And we're going to be struggling with responding to this pandemic for a long time. Even after, let's say, they magically get a vaccine in early next year, it's going to be a while before we've reached, you know, I don't want to use that term loosely, but herd immunity, so to speak, right? Where everybody is inoculated against this. And we're all experimenting right now across the country in ways that we could resume back to life as normal. But there's going to be continual surges of coronavirus patients that are being seen by hospitals and health systems. And that's something that CFOs, it's hard for them to predict that, right, against the bottom line. I hate to think about it that way, but that is something that has to be thought about.
Well, and absolutely. I mean, you still have to pay your bills. You still have to go on. You know there's going to be a surge. I would also counter, though, with that, is that instead of going back to what you were operating and how you were doing pre-pandemic, how do you have to operate now going forward? And how do you maintain an engagement with the community and with your patients about things that they need to continue to do to lessen the impact? I mean, there's a public health social medicine aspect of this going forward for them. It's the new normal. You've set yourself up as a leader in the community. You've engaged, you've communicated, you've taught people about what's going on. That has to continue. It's just not the focus of, well, what am I going to do inside the hospital? What am I going to do outside to whatever extent that I can do and influence the community in lessening? Like you said, there will be outbreaks. There's going to be new hotspots. There's going to be new surges. Now, those surges in and of itself, the economy has to reopen. But those surges aren't happening because the economy is reopening. Those surges are happening because individuals will be getting lax. They won't social distance. They won't wear masks. That's the inherent issue that from a public health and even hospital and even governmental perspective of what's going to cause the surges. If people were social distancing, if people were wearing their masks and doing the things, you know, washing hands and so forth and so on, you would still have surges, but they wouldn't be as big as they're going to be because people get lazy. And that's just human nature. I'm not being negative. It's just human nature. The other thing that hospital CFOs have to face is they have to create a stockpile now. They can't have 3 days worth of supplies, you know, on a order as needed basis. And, you know, and I worked with Premier. I was one of the original regional vice presidents with Premier when it was formed back in the 90s, when you had all those mergers going on. You know, hospitals had 3 days worth of supplies on hand. Guess what? There's no one there to ride to the rescue. There was no government stockpile. There was no regional stockpile. There was no, you couldn't go to a sister hospital and go, give me your PPE. Now they're going to have the expense of creating their own stockpile. How are you going to pay for that within this? Because the government's not going to ride to the rescue. God bless the public health service and the military. When you look at what the military did to mobilize with the field hospitals, with the staff and the things that they had, hopefully there were lessons that the hospital industry is learning from how the military handles healthcare and how they respond to a crisis. But you can't have just, well, I'm only going to maintain 3 days of inventory now because it impacts the bottom line. You got to have more.
I read something about the decline of the just-in-time economy and the impacts to the supply chain. And I'm also intrigued, too, by what's going on in these, you know, we hear about these different regions across the United States where states are coming together, like in the Northeast area with New York and a number of the states around there, where they're actually creating an oversight at the state level, well, multi-state level, around supply chain stockpiles and things like that in order to manage costs. That could be an interesting approach to how we solve that problem, I think, in the future. But it's like our whole model, economic model, has been shifted.
It's been turned upside down and it will never be what it was. I think, again, another silver lining, though, is going to be bring clarity for payers, clarity for the hospitals, clarity for the individuals, clarity for the government. So now what those steps are, I don't know, but I really believe that the steps needed to fix the current situation so that we minimize, I don't know if you can ever completely eliminate it, but minimize the financial disruptions that have occurred today from happening to such an extent in the future. A new model needs to be invented. And I guess that brings up the question too of what is the role of the government going to be in all this model? And is this the impetus now that is going to push us over the top to national healthcare? that provides at least a minimum level of health care, guaranteed health care for all individuals.
And duly noted that you're saying that from a nonpartisan perspective.
Correct.
Right? Yeah, this absolutely. About, you're right. Well, whenever we talk about, you know, universal health care or like approaches to that, suddenly that's taken on a very much of a political or partisan tinge to it. As we look at across the world too, the countries that are successfully approaching the management of this coronavirus, while it's still very contagious and still novel and new, they have mobilized from a private and a public approach to really address this. And they've implemented longstanding changes, but they've been resting on the fact that they've had those safety net built into their governments.
And I've had the great fortune in my career to work internationally as well. You know, when I was just across Canada, United States, Latin America, Mexico, and then the home office of the medical device company was in Europe. So I was constantly over in Europe and getting a good look at healthcare internationally. It's really kind of interesting. I think what's happened is someone says universal health here, they automatically assume, oh, it's single payer, it's the government taking over. Oh my God, you know, this is, I'm going to lose everything. If people were to take a step back and look like what's going on, except for like England, you know, Canada, China, and a few other countries, there's universal health care, but I say that with a caveat. There is private insurance, there is employer insurance, and then there is government, you know, taking over and providing health care and health insurance for the individuals that don't have any. So it's a combination. There are very few places in the world where the government pays for the health care. And by the way, they are wrestling with the same kind of cost issues that we do, and they're far more organized than we've ever been. When I talk of universal health care, I'm not talking about a single payer. I don't want the government in charge of my health care. They have a hard enough time running the VA, you know, which does provide really good care. My father was a veteran and experienced that care firsthand. So I experienced that care delivery firsthand. But at the end of the day, it's how do we now refocus and meld private insurance, employer insurance, the payers, and the government to provide universal health care? And that's a discussion that hasn't really ever taken place. It becomes so polarized, it's universal, it's either single payer or nothing. Well, it can't be that. It has to be a blend. And I hope that maybe this crisis, the pandemic, will get us to some point where we can have a rational, reasonable discussion about this going forward. Because what's the economy going to look like in 6 months? Are we going to be in a depression? Are we going to be deep into a recession? Will people actually be recalling going back to work? I can see exponentially how this can be compounded over the coming months if things aren't addressed or planned for.
It certainly reinforces the fact that I wouldn't want to be a CFO right now in a hospital or health system, because it's very challenging ahead. But I think it's challenging for everyone, from the individual patient all the way through, because of the complexity that you outlined. Michael, thank you for this conversation and thank you for your insights. That was incredibly thought-provoking.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. I enjoyed being here.
The healthcare delivery system in the U.S. is complex, and while health systems struggle to find a way to stay solvent throughout and after the pandemic, the immediate future seems very bleak. And while efforts have been made by government, healthcare payers, and others to help offset some of these challenges, much like the coronavirus pandemic, this new fiscal landscape is novel and unprecedented. Recent reports have also shown that larger health systems have had more advantages navigating through this crisis than smaller rural systems. But is this a sustainable financial way forward for the future of our healthcare system? Are we really in a world where we must go big or go home? You have been listening to The New Normal, conversations about the future of healthcare from Touchpoint Media. If you enjoyed today's program, take a moment to rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you downloaded this show. The music from this program is I Don't Know by Grapes and is available as a royalty-free download available on ccmixter.org. To find out more about Touchpoint Media, please visit us online at touchpoint.health.